This podcast is brought to you by Berry Brothers and Rudd, sponsors of Great Conversation.
Welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman. This week we'll be discussing what the first 100 days after Brexit could look like, whether Hillary Clinton's success is really a victory for feminism, and Toby Young's joy at following England in the Euro Football Championships. So first up, if Britain votes out of the EU on June the 23rd, what would the next 100 days be like? The Prime Minister has famously predicted disastrous consequences, saying Brexit would plant a bomb under the economy. But what would life outside the EU mean for Britain? Writing in The Spectator this week, James Forsyth says a vote to leave would be the most dramatic moment in British political history. So what can we expect? I'm joined now by Christopher Mayer and James to discuss the UK's Brexit strategy. So James, how much planning do you think David Cameron has actually done for the first 100 days after a vote for Brexit?
Well, very little. I think it is something he doesn't really want to think about. But he would obviously be faced with several huge questions. First of all, does he resign? Now, I was talking to someone the other day who's known Cameron since he first entered politics, and he thinks Cameron's sense of public service is too strong for him to resign, but that Cameron would know that he couldn't conduct the exit negotiations with the public having rejected his renegotiation. So I think the most likely scenario is that Cameron stays on as a kind of caretaker prime minister until the Tory conference in October. But then the two things Cameron have to do between June the 24th and October is he'd have to decide whether or not to invoke Article 50, the process for leaving the EU. He has said repeatedly throughout his campaign he would invoke it immediately if Britain voted to leave. I think in reality he probably wouldn't, because the cabinet wouldn't want him to. His potential successors as prime minister wouldn't want him to. They would want to leave some time for tempers to cool. And then the other thing he'd have to do is have to work out how to unsay some of the things that he has said about the economy. He has compared Brexit to putting a bomb under the economy. He's talked repeatedly about a fall in the value of the pound. He'd have to work out how to kind of reassure the markets and how to stabilise the currency.
It sounds, Christopher, like there's going to be quite a lot of panic if there is a Brexit vote, particularly amongst ministers. Is this the moment at which civil servants, diplomats take control?
Provided that they too are not panicking. It could be that there's panic everywhere and everybody's like a rabbit in the headlights. I would hope that inside the Foreign Office, that in one of the departments like the policy planning staff, they already have a plan for the first 100 days after Brexit. Now, this may not have been approved by the Foreign Secretary, it may not have even been seen by a junior minister, but the Foreign Office that I used to know and love would have already either embarked on this or have it ready, so that if the people decide to do Brexit, they have something which they can put up at cabinet level for the short and, I guess, medium term.
I think one of the crucial things to remember is that until Britain invokes Article 50, nothing changes. So if the British Prime Minister said, right, I'm not invoking it, I'm going to just allow some time to work out what we want to do, you know, the timetable is in Britain's control. I personally think it would be sensible to leave it for as long as possible. There are French and German elections in 2017. The one thing you don't want as a British Prime Minister is the British exit negotiations getting caught up in the domestic politics of the French and German elections.
Is that, James, is that for you an argument for getting the negotiations out of the way before the German and French elections?
No, I think it's an argument for letting it go. For playing it as long as possible. And because I think the more time, you know, the other crucial thing, the thing that Boris Johnson and Michael Gove would have to do is they would have to reassure Europe. They'd have to reassure Europe that this was not Britain leaving Europe, but this was Britain leaving the European Union, which is a different thing. I mean, they'd have to emphasise that they still wanted to take part in efforts to, you know, combat Russian revanchism or to help out in terms of dealing with the situation in Libya. And they'd have to show the world and the global business community in particular that this is about, not about Britain drawing up the drawbridge, but this is about Britain pursuing a more liberal economic policy. I think one thing that some people on the Leave side talk about is a cut in the corporation tax rate to 10% as a way of demonstrating that Britain's still open for business.
And that's another job for the diplomats, isn't it? To go around the world saying, well, we're not drawing in on ourselves, actually. This is just a change in our relationship with one set of countries.
That is right. And I think that the Prime Minister, if he's still Prime Minister, and all the Foreign Secretary need to get up very soon after the 23rd of June and make a great speech and lay out these principles very, very strongly. And then, as is the way, the speech is then sent round the world to all our missions, and the missions, the ambassadors and high commissioners, are instructed to go in at the highest possible level and say, here is this speech, please read it. This shows that we have not lost our blue waters vocation, which has been part of our history since time immemorial. And then I think there should be real hard-edged practical things, like cutting corporation tax so that investors don't get panicky, like maybe making an offer to the world of tariff-free trade with the United Kingdom, provided that you offer us the same preferential treatment. 0.5% more on the MOD budget, ring-fenced for NATO.
I mean, one thing that the British government could do post-Brexit would be take something that came up in the negotiations. The Poles wanted Britain's support for a NATO base in Poland. I think coming out and saying that Britain supported and would contribute to a NATO base in Poland would be a way of saying, look, this isn't about Britain renouncing its international commitments. This isn't about Britain turning in on itself. This is about Britain changing the nature of its relationship with the European Union, because that is going in a centralising direction that Britain doesn't want to follow. I think one thing Boris Johnson talked about in private is how a new Prime Minister post-Brexit, you can guess who that might be, would have to go on a kind of tour.
Theresa May.
Yes, would have to go on a tour of European capitals to explain both to the elites and to the people what this vote was about. And it wasn't about a rejection of the idea that Britain is a European country, but a decision not to be part of the European Union.
How receptive do you think those European countries, European leaders, would be to that sort of tour?
Well, I think that there will be a kind of giant strategic rift running through the remaining members of the European Union. There will be those who really don't want this to encourage others to go down the same path. So there will be people, not a million miles from Paris, for example, who would really quite like to punish us for being so outrageous and leaving the Union. There will be others, like the Germans, with whom we have, what's the phrase, bigger supply trains. Of highly advanced industrial products, with virtually a single economy, who will not want to see this kind of rupture and will try and think of some kind of soft landing, which won't be so soft that it doesn't gain the support of the other member states, and isn't an inducement for others to leave. I think that the final decision on Article 50 has to be taken by qualified majority voting, not by unanimity, on those core areas where there is Commission competence. So that'll be the split, broadly speaking, in Europe, and we will already start to gain allies and make enemies. And I absolutely agree with you, James, that we should wait to invoke Article 50, because in effect we're going into a second phase of negotiation on the reform of the European Union.
Well, and Cameron's got quite a lot to do in the meantime anyway. As you say in your column, one of his other challenges is to say all the things that he said about the economic consequences, unsay all the things he said about the economic consequences of Brexit.
And World War III.
Yes. All of these warnings about putting a bomb under the economy. How credible will it really be for him to turn around and say, well, I didn't really mean it, everyone calm down?
Yes, when did he say it was just the rough and tumble of the campaign?
Yes.
I think the Bank of England has a huge role to play here. I mean, one of the great things about having kept hold of your own currency and having your own central bank that can print money is that you have an ability to prop up your own currency, that you can do things to stabilise things which countries that do not have their own currency cannot do. I think there will obviously need to be some things done to reassure international investors about what is going to happen. And I think that's another reason not to invoke Article 50 straight away, to basically say to people, look, hang on a second, we're not going to do this in the heat of the moment, we're going to have time to work this out. I think one thing on Christopher's point, which is fascinating, is a British exit would, I think, exacerbate divides within the EU. It's quite noticeable that the two countries in the EU that have a trade surplus with us are Germany and Holland. And so, therefore, logically, you would think they would be the countries that are keenest to do a deal. I mean, they're also two of the countries that would be most worried about how Britain leaving the EU would shift the balance in Europe between kind of liberal and protectionist countries. So I think watch the effect on the European Union will be absolutely fascinating too.
I think there's another thing here as well, because this is going to be really choppy waters to navigate, and it's going to require incredibly skilled negotiation. So institutionally, I would like to see that being led by the Foreign Office. I assume that Philip Hammond will be Foreign Secretary, but it's not a given, is it? But what we are short of, because we haven't done this for so long, is really skilled negotiators at the technical level who are able to be tough when it's necessary to be tough and to bend when it's necessary to bend. I don't think that the negotiation that Cameron did to reform the inside of the European Union was conducted in that skillful way. And the challenge now is going to be 10 times as hard, and we need even better people. It's going to be difficult.
One lesson from the Cameron renegotiation is this: if you basically tell everyone that you want to get a deal quite quickly, you don't get a good deal. That's another reason not to invoke Article 50 straight away, because that sets a 2-year clock ticking. You basically want to say that you're prepared to play this long. And I think one of the big things is, this is why I suspect that the next Prime Minister, if we voted out, would have to be someone who themselves had backed and campaigned for Brexit, because they would have the credibility to say to the public, no, no, this isn't some establishment stitch-up to keep us in.
Yeah, this
is about getting the best deal. They'd have to have a credibility to take the process on for quite a while.
Do you think Theresa May, officially in the Remain campaign, would have that credibility?
I think Theresa May... position is perfect if it's a narrow in vote, because what she's come up with is a peace plan for within the Tory party, which is, okay, we stay in the EU, but there's no further enlargement of the EU, and we keep a watching brief on whether we would leave or not. I think it would be very difficult for any politician who themselves have voted to stay to explain to the public why we weren't trying to leave in a hurry, why we were taking our time about it. I think that's what's difficult.
That was Christopher Mayer and James Forsyth. And now a word from our sponsors.
If you've ever wanted to start a wine cellar, 2016 is the perfect year to begin. Berry Brothers & Rudd's cellar plan is designed to suit every taste and budget. To find out more, visit bbr.com/cellar plan.
Next, Hillary Clinton has crossed the line in the race to become the Democrat nominee. Here's what she had to say.
We've reached a milestone. The first time in our nation's history that a woman will be a major party's nominee.
But is Hillary's success really a victory for women? In The Spectator this week, Emily Hill argues that Hillary's rise to the top is anything but an ultimate triumph for feminism. And I'm joined now by The Spectator's Freddie Gray and Kate Andrews from the Republican Party overseas. So Kate, Emily in her piece in the magazine says that Hillary is no sort of feminist at all. Do you agree with that?
Part of my issue with feminism is that I think that it is being too narrowly defined. So perhaps Hillary Clinton thinks she's a feminist. And I would say that certain things that she's represented, especially over the years, probably relate to feminism. But in 2016, I think Emily is completely right. The idea that young women should be told that they are bad women, bad feminists, whatever it is, because they're not supporting the first female president is absolutely ridiculous. Hillary Clinton does not represent for me or for Emily or for a lot of women what we would like to see in the first female president. Somebody who's stuck to a few policy issues would be great. Somebody who isn't under investigation for corruption would be great. If women are going to be represented on that national level and hold the Oval Office, I'd like it to be somebody that I can relate to and be proud of.
So you don't buy the argument that says this is the chance to get a woman into the White House and you should seize it with both hands, because even though she's not perfect, she's a woman.
No, not at all. I put gender secondary to people's accomplishments and you know, I'm a supporter of meritocracy and what they can do with their lives. There are so many successful women out there, Republican and Democrat at the moment, in the United States who are holding elected office, who could be president of the United States one day. I'd be willing to support a Democrat potentially if she were the kind of woman I would want representing America.
Freddie, do you think Donald Trump is actually preferable to Hillary when it comes to feminism and women's issues?
For women voters? Well, as Emily points out in her brilliant piece, I mean, he is deploying Camille Paglia's argument about Hillary, which is that she actually was complicit in Bill Clinton's sexual abuse of a number of women, allegedly. But I think Hillary is not an attractive figure for women. I think polls show that a majority of women oppose her, 58% oppose her compared to 68% for Donald Trump. And so it's a relief for a man like me who doesn't like Hillary Clinton because of her career as a politician to see that feminists can oppose her, and they can oppose her without sort of being having what men have to do, which is be accused of being misogynist.
Kate, do you agree with Emily's argument that by standing by Bill Clinton, Hillary has not been a feminist? That the best thing to do, as she says at the end, would have been to divorce him and forge her own identity apart from him.
I have really mixed feelings on this. I think looking at the Monica Lewinsky scandal as an isolated scandal, you could see a scenario where a woman could be empowered by leaving her husband or by staying with her husband. I do not think it's the case that if a woman is cheated on at some point in her life, she's a bad woman or a bad feminist for working on the relationship. You know, I don't think we should be putting that message out there to couples. Who are we to judge your lifelong partnership? However, in Hillary Clinton's case and Bill Clinton's case, the problem is not that it was ever an isolated incident. His time as governor in Arkansas, there are terrible accusations against him, but there's a lot of speculation that he has been involved in affairs when he was governor, in the White House, and since then. And there doesn't seem to be any remorse. And I think what people are so deeply uncomfortable with is that their relationship has proven to be one of convenience. It is not that they're together because they seem like they're in love and they work through their issues. It's because they're always seeking power. I think that is the fundamental problem, and why people feel that is very uncomfortable that the first female president could potentially be also the wife of a former president.
And this is something that makes voters uncomfortable generally, doesn't it, Freddie? The sense that Hillary's part of an establishment clique, that she's someone who feels entitled to winning the presidential race rather than someone who sort of pulled themselves up by their bootstraps.
Yes, I think the Clinton machine is exactly what feeds into the general disgust and antipathy towards politics and politicians that you have today. And as Christopher Buckley said so brilliantly a few weeks ago, you know, if you think Americans are angry now, just wait till they have 4 years of Hillary Clinton. They're going to be frothing at the mouth.
Do you think women are going to be particularly angry, Kate, given they're not particularly big fans of Hillary, given Donald Trump, for all the praise that we've just heaped on him, is not exactly that helpful to women either in lots of ways?
Oh yeah, I'm not heaping any praise on Donald Trump. I think women in particular are going to have a really hard time in this election. I think Americans in general have been put in a tough spot. You have two New York elitists who are competing for the presidency. They both have skeletons in their closet. Neither seems particularly trustworthy, and they both have serious issues with women. So I think Americans on the whole are in a tough spot, but it's hard to know what to do as a woman in this scenario. Neither seem to be championing women's rights in the way I would like them to. They're not doing it from a free market perspective. Hillary Clinton wants to regulate the market more and suggests that, you know, women can't really fight for themselves when they go into salary conversations, that women need more protection from their employers. I don't see the evidence for that, and I don't like making them victims. But I also can't stand to listen to Donald Trump attack female journalists for being on their period, and that's why they're not able to ask him legitimate questions. This is a terrible situation for women, frankly. It's hard to know what to do.
Do you think Hillary will succeed in persuading Sanders' voters to back her now, Freddie?
I think that'll be very interesting. I suspect among the younger voters, although she does have problems with young women, that most will end up lumping for Hillary. It's the older, perhaps call them kookier, Bernie voters who I think will go straight to Trump because it's a purely anti-establishment choice.
I also think a lot of them will stay home. There was a poll not too long ago that showed that 47% of Bernie Sanders supporters were not going to support Hillary Clinton. That was because some would vote for Donald Trump, some would vote for third party, but a lot said that they wanted to stay home.
Yes, exactly. That's Hillary's real great problem, is her just fundamental boringness. I mean, you know, here we are. She's just clinched the Democratic nomination, a huge moment in American history. And who's really excited about it? There are a few people pretending to be excited about it, but they're not, because she's a boring figure. It was actually a very boring race towards the end against Bernie Sanders. And, you know, these sort of constant referrals to the glass ceiling and the sort of smashing down ball, it doesn't have the same feel as Obama in 2008, because it's not the same story. It's not an exciting story.
What glass ceiling is she really smashing? I think that's part of the problem as well, is that Barack Obama really grew out of the grassroots and came out of nowhere and went on to win the presidency, campaigning on hope and change. I would argue that he really in many ways has not succeeded in what he promised, but in 2007, people were so excited. Hillary Clinton comes from a huge amount of wealth. She's already been in the White House for 8 years. It doesn't really seem like this is a success story in any way.
That was Freddie Gray and Kate Andrews. And finally, with the Euro Football Championship starting this week, is being an England fan worth the pain? Writing in the magazine this week, Toby Young says that despite all the ups and downs of following our national team, he couldn't be more excited about cheering England on. Here he is to explain why.
So Toby, you say in your piece that for proper football supporters, getting excited about England playing is considered a bit uncool. Why is that?
I think it's because if you're a club football fan, you are an ardent supporter of your club. But international football, you can take or leave. And actually, it can be a bit of a worry if one of your star performers is selected to play in an international squad, because there's a risk of injury and that could impact on their club performance.
It's fascinating, though, isn't it? Because it's no more or less arbitrary than supporting Grimsby Town or Man U just because you were born, or maybe not born in some cases, in those cities than it is to support England because you were born in England. So is it just that there's something more kind of sincere about supporting a local football team than supporting your country's football?
I think, I mean, I don't want to exaggerate this, and I'm sure there are, you know, millions of England fans out there, as we'll see from the flags that'll start appearing later this week. But I think that because club football is week in, week out, for, you know, something like 9 months of the year now, people form much, much stronger attachments to their local teams than they do to international teams, which only play, you know, once in a blue moon.
And so why are you personally excited about the Euros?
I'm excited. I mean, I've been an England fan for as long as I can remember, possibly because I'm only a Johnny-come-lately to club football, having only been a QPR fan for about 10 years. I mean, I'm also, I fall into the kind of cliched category of the kind of inauthentic middle-class prawn sandwich-eating fan too, and don't really know a huge amount about football, even though I enjoy it. So, for instance, I was going to Israel to see England versus Israel, which was a qualifier in 2007 for the Euro 2008 tournament. And I was seated on the British Airways flight across from Glenn Hoddle, the former England manager, and trying to strike up a conversation with him. I said, "So, Glenn, how come Craig Bellamy's not been selected for the England squad?" And he gave me a slightly puzzled look and said, "Well, because he's Welsh." And it was quite difficult to get anywhere with Glenn after that.
Now, you mentioned that you'll be watching the Euros with your children in this piece, and I have to say, whenever I go to football matches, one of the things I love about it the most is seeing children really excited about seeing their team play. Does it make you more excited to be watching football with your children than previously? Has that got a kind of extra ingredient to it?
Yes, I think it does. I mean, I've got four children, and the only one who really likes football is the seven-year-old, and he's quite good at playing it too. And I'm looking forward to watching all the games with him. I'll try and rope the others in too.
They'll be forced to watch it too.
Well, they may be on their tablets while we're watching the football. I mean, I think for me, I hope to kindle in the breast of my children what was kindled in me when I watched the 1990 World Cup, in which England got as far as the semi-finals and were knocked out in a famous penalty shootout by West Germany. And that was, for me, a kind of defining moment when my love for the England team was lit. And one of the things that happens when you're watching any sport, particularly international sport, is that a kind of act of transference takes place, in which the sportsmen or sportswomen become kind of your tribunes. And it's not something as straightforward as just imagining yourself in their shoes. It's almost more visceral than that, like a kind of, at moments, an out-of-body experience in which you can somehow, you're in the thick of the action, you're caught up in the drama. And you'd think that that kind of transference would be easier in individual sports like tennis, where you can just kind of put yourself into the body of an individual representing your country or your team. But actually in football, where you're flitting around from player to player, it somehow becomes a more powerful feeling. It's like almost as though you're a kind of an evil spirit in a kind of horror film, kind of possessing people and flitting from person to person. So whoever's got the ball, whoever's in the thick of the action, that's who you are in that moment. And I've never experienced that kind of out-of-body sensation more powerfully than when England competed in that tournament as they progressed through the tournament.
But realistically, aren't you cruelly opening up your children to a life of disappointment in encouraging them to enjoy football? England don't tend to do very well.
Yeah, well, as QPR supporters, they're already pretty inured to disappointment, and however poorly England do in this tournament, it's unlikely they'll fare as badly as QPR has done this season, where they finished in sort of mid-table mediocrity in the championship. I think it's true that there is, of course, a danger if you become a passionate football fan, that you know, if you measure it according to a utilitarian calculus, it's probably going to make you more miserable than it is happy. All I can say is that because of that kind of general climate of misery, when your team does succeed, the intensity of the happiness that you feel almost compensates for that kind of lifetime of misery and pain.
And so does that mean you're hopeful that England does have a chance this summer, or are you trying to be reasonably realistic?
I always kind of, it's a kind of head and heart thing. I mean, in my head, I say, you know, England are bound to disappoint. They always do. We didn't even get out of the group stage in the last international tournament, the World Cup, 2 years ago. But in my heart, I think, my God, we've got a fantastic team. They're bursting with talent. Kane and Vardy, our two leading strikers, got 49 league goals between them in the season just gone. You know, if we've ever had a chance of winning an international tournament, this has got to be our year. So, you know, however much you try and prepare yourself by kind of tamping down your expectations, inevitably on the eve of a tournament like this, at least for England fans like me, you get carried away. And in the end, you end up being incredibly optimistic.
That was Toby Young on following England's footballing fortunes. And that's all for this week. You can subscribe to this podcast on the iTunes store by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. And a reminder that podcast listeners can also enjoy a special subscription rate of 22 issues for £22 by going to spectator.co.uk/22.